The following is an encore broadcast of Jazz Profiles. This tribute to the Village Vanguard was produced in 2001.
This room is filled with sound every day. The piano needs tuning. The carpet needs cleaning. The ice chest needs refilling. The glasses need washing. It's all in preparation for nighttime, when the real sound fills the air. This isn't just any room, of course. It's New York City's Village Vanguard, the oldest continuously running jazz club in the world. And all the spirits of jazz hold court here.
You know, when you step out on that stage, you can feel the presence of Sonny Rollins. You can feel the presence of Thelonious Monk. You can feel the presence of Miles Davis. You can feel the presence of John Coltrane, of all the geniuses who've played here.
Saxophonist Joshua Redman.
And so it demands the highest level of musicianship and artistry that you can muster on any given night, because it has settled for no less than that from everyone who has walked through these doors.
When the Village Vanguard first opened in 1935, it wasn't strictly a jazz club. It was also staged to folk musicians, poets, actors, and comedians, like Woody Allen.
The Vanguard was a joint, and the people that came to the Vanguard were jazz devotees and people who knew about Nichols and May and knew about Lenny Bruce and knew about Thelonious Monk and, you know, artists that were emerging but were not yet fully appreciated by the audiences they eventually came to entrance.
It was very eclectic, a large variety of different artists, from a man by the name of Burl Ives to another man by the name of Richard Dyer Bennett to Josh White, Maxine Sullivan, Woody Guthrie, and Pete Seeger, myself.
John Henry, he could hammer, he could whistle, he could sing. Went to the mountain early in the morning just to hear his hammer ring. Lord, Lord, just to hear his hammer ring. Just to hear his hammer ring. Lord, Lord, just to hear his hammer ring.
Like many before him, singer Harry Belafonte got his first big break from Vanguard founder Max Gordon.
I found in Max a person who was really most protective, not only of the Vanguard, but of what he tried to achieve and using the Village Vanguard to become a sounding board for the culture of America, especially the ethnic culture.
In the mid-1950s, the Vanguard narrowed its scope to present jazz only. Since then, it has become well known for its fierce commitment to this music. Saxophonist Branford Marcellus plays here almost every year.
There are no accoutrements in the club that would make people that don't like jazz come here. They don't have golf balls with their logo on it. They don't have svelte waiters and waitresses with bow ties on. They don't serve food. The drinks are watered down. No, but, you know, it's just the whole thing is just, if you're not here to listen to the music, you're not going to really enjoy yourself.
The room squeezes in only 123 people, which creates an exchange between artist and audience that is rare. Pianist McCoy Tyner recorded at the Vanguard as a member of John Coltrane's group.
It's such an intimate place. I mean, you can hear everything. I mean, you know, there's so little space between you and the musicians on stage and the audience that it's like everybody's participating. It's a group effort.
There's something about that room. It's unglitzy. It's kind of common in a way.
Lorraine Gordon has owned and operated the club since 1989, the year her husband, Max Gordon, died.
Sometimes people come from Europe because they've heard about it and they want to see it. I remember one couple walked in and said, is this it? Well, you know, looked a little abashed. I said, this is it. That's all there is. Yes, indeed. Sit down. When you hear the music, you'll understand the transformations that take place.
It has become, perhaps, the most famous basement in New York City. Just a little pie-shaped room with low ceiling and remarkably wonderful acoustics. And it's been the setting for more than 100 live recordings, many of which are considered to be essential works in the history of recorded jazz. I'm Nancy Wilson. On this edition of Jazz Profiles, it's a tribute to New York's historic Village Vanguard.
God, this is horrible.
It takes a certain kind of person to lead the life of a nightclub owner in New York City.
Hi, thanks a lot. Make a left on Greenwich Avenue up there.
Lorraine Gordon has been called the Queen Mother of Jazz. Approaching 80, she still works 6 days a week, taking the same trip through Greenwich Village over to the Vanguard on 7th Avenue.
Go straight, straight, straight! Greenwich Avenue, not street. I go through this every night.
Can you just
straight, no, Greenwich Avenue.
Okay, I understand. But
I know, everybody makes that mistake.
She unlocks the same heavy wooden door. And makes her way down the notoriously steep staircase.
Sometimes I count how many millions of feet went up and down these stairs.
Once the eyes adjust to the dark, a little room reveals itself. Red leather banquettes line the walls, and small tables and chairs are crowded together in the middle. All face the stage, which is draped in the Vanguard's signature red velvet curtains. The most arresting feature, however, is the photographs. They cover almost every inch of wall space.
They're all pictures that my husband was very fond of and friends of his, Bill Evans. And there's Elvin Jones and Charlie Mingus. Thelonious Monk, my true favorite, and Miles Davis, I'm my favorite too. But nothing here gets touched, it's just the inner museum.
Good afternoon, everybody. Boys and girls, this is Uncle Don. good afternoon, my name is Sonny Rollins, and we have Donald Bailey on bass and Pete LaRocca on drums.
Vanguard's photographs tell quite a story. It's the recordings made here that bring its history to life. This one, from 1957, is the first, and it's still widely considered to be one of the best live albums in jazz. Joshua Redman.
That record is definitely, I think, a benchmark for jazz improvisers and for live jazz performers. I mean, it's one of the great live records of all times. And there's something about listening to that record, it articulates in no uncertain terms Sonny Rollins' genius as an improviser. Because it's one thing to hear that genius in a studio context, but to hear him doing that live with even more reckless abandon and more raw intensity, it was like proof that this cat could do this every time, every note, every set.
Thank you. A Night in Tunisia, Sonny Rollins, with Donald Bailey on bass and Pete LaRocca on drums. From Sonny Rollins, A Night at the Village Vanguard, recorded in 1957. One aspect of the Vanguard that sets it apart from other clubs is its acoustic properties. No one seems to have a technical explanation for it, but no matter where you sit in the room, in the front row, back of the bar, or on the sides, the sound is equally good. Both listeners and musicians marvel at it. Again, Joshua Redman.
There is no other venue in the world for jazz that sounds like this one does. It's the acoustically perfect room for jazz. You can hear all the range of tonal possibilities in this room, and I don't know what it is. It's the wood, it's the shape, it's the carpeting, it's the upholstery, and it's probably, I hate to sound too spiritual, but it's probably the vibes.
As Max would say, the room has vibes. It kind of pulsates. You know, if you come there often enough, what that means.
Musicians, I understand from some of them, I've talked to them, of course, about it. They prefer this room to other rooms that are opening up. They talk about the vibes, the vibrations of the place.
Max Gordon, from a late 1970s film interview.
But they think back of the people that have appeared here, John Coltrane, Miles Davis, Sonny Rollins, Lester Young, all these people who have appeared at the Vanguard, somehow or other, it seems like they've left something of themselves here in the place. They talk about it, the vibes. Well, maybe they got something there.
You're listening to NPR's Jazz Profiles, a tribute to the Village Vanguard. I'm Nancy Wilson. Max Gordon opened the Village Vanguard doors in February 1935, and the place wasn't much different back then.
The Village Vanguard is just as casual as it ever was. Physically, it's exactly the same.
Legendary Broadway writing team, Betty Comden and Adolph Green, got their very first writing and performing experience at the Vanguard. It was in 1938, and with their 16-year-old friend, Judy Holliday, who would later become the famous film star, they formed a variety group called The Reviewers. The act attracted noted Greenwich Village crowds.
Wonderful audience.
An audience out of nowhere, suddenly.
The whole staff of the New Yorker used to come down. You know, they knew they would pay attention.
And people and men of letters of all kinds, authors, writers, all kinds of folk. Yeah. The cream of the theater and literary world, wonderful people.
It could be said that a club's audience reflects the sensibility of the club's owner.
Max just... Well, he was always a very nice man, I must say. And not like a nightclub boss, as you would think of as a nightclub boss.
Sort of philosophical.
And we used to have him work our lights sometimes, our primitive lighting. So we would often yell out, Maximovich, blackout!
Blackout, yes.
He'd be busy with a customer, and we wouldn't get a blackout at the end of the sketch.
Lorraine Gordon.
He was a very quiet little man, very scholarly, graduated Reed College. He read Russian novels from morning till night, and was very gentle with people, and they liked that about him.
I just remember him as very warm and supportive of a number of acts who were difficult at the time. I wasn't difficult, I was just a nervous wreck.
The Vanguard was one of the very first places Woody Allen ever performed as a comedian. Though more than 30 years have passed, he could be describing it today.
I remember that there was no dressing room there. There was just a little kind of office at the back of the place. that looked like it was in a state constantly of moving. I mean, there were furniture piled in there and cartons piled in. And between shows, either you'd be forced to go up and walk around the streets, which I did most of the time. But if you wanted to go into the dressing room, you know, you'd have to find a spot on a desk or a carton or a table or the floor. You know, looked like a big closet at my aunt's house.
I bummed around for a long time, and I met my wife. And we got married against my parents' wishes. We were married in Long Island in New York. We were married by a reform rabbi in Long Island. A very reform rabbi. A Nazi.
The Village Vanguard was, for all intended purposes, the place to begin, the place to start. And for me to have had this opportunity, I think, was very critical to the early successes that I experienced.
Harry Belafonte was one of the many undiscovered talents nurtured by Max Gordon.
I always admired Max because his course was always, I thought, filled with great clarity. He was very much a part of the progressive politics of the day. He encouraged people to fight against segregation. He was vehemently anti-racist. He used his base and his platform to give many people access to making a difference in how America was viewing itself and how all of our citizens treated each other.
This audience in 1959 was a far cry from the one at the Vanguard. Here's Harry Belafonte, less than 8 years after his Vanguard debut, live at Carnegie Hall.
Day-o, day-o. Daylight come and me wanna go home. Day, me said 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 day. Daylight come and me wanna go home. Work all night and I drink a rum. Stack banana till the morning come.
Daylight come and we won't go home.
Come Mr. Tallyman and tally me banana.
Daylight come and we won't go home.
We say come Mr. Tallyman and tally me banana.
Daylight come and we won't go home.
In the mid-1950s, Max Gordon decided to limit the Vanguard's fare to jazz only. He was highly respected by the musicians and a friend to many, among them Miles Davis, Dexter Gordon, Elvin Jones, Charles Mingus, and pianist Bill Evans, who made more recordings at the Vanguard than any other musician. From The Secret Sessions, this is Bill Evans in 1966 with his theme, Five. Musicians were tougher for Max Gordon to get to know, like saxophonist John Coltrane.
Coltrane never talked very much. He was a very shy man. I used to talk to his wife more than talk to him. Yeah, Coltrane was great. There's no doubt about it. He was one of the outstanding men. He was a giant.
John Coltrane and his group played frequently at the Vanguard between 1961 and 1966. The pianist in that group, McCoy Tyner, remembers those days.
You come down a long stairway, and I used to see Max negotiating the stairway.
And he would be there every night. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And the atmosphere there, it's just such a classic jazz place. I mean, it's like sitting in your living room. Literally, it's like sitting in your living room without the fireplace. But the fire's on stage and the musicians are playing.
This is John Coltrane, live at the Village Vanguard, The Master Takes, recorded in 1961, with Eric Dolphy on bass clarinet, McCoy Tyner on piano, Reggie Workman on bass, and Elvin Jones on drums. The piece is Spiritual. Spiritual, John Coltrane, live at the Village Vanguard in 1961. Jazz was in for some hard times during the 1960s. By the end of the decade, the last club on New York's famed 52nd Street had closed. None of the early jazz places in Harlem remained. A few clubs in the village stuck it out. But the temptation to forego acoustic jazz in favor of more lucrative acts like rock and roll and fusion was great. The Vanguard didn't succumb. It pursued its course and continues to do so today, as you'll hear. I'm Nancy Wilson. You're listening to Jazz Profiles, a tribute to the Village Vanguard, from NPR National Public Radio. The Village Vanguard has presented live jazz 6 to 7 nights a week without exception. With such offerings, it's always had a devoted audience. In its earliest days, one of its most avid listeners was a young fan from New Jersey who used to take the train into the city whenever she got the chance.
I didn't even know Max. I used to come from New Jersey with my pals because we were jazz lovers then.
Lorraine Gordon.
We were the Newark Hot Club. We were a little special group. And we'd get in somehow, hang out at the bar, buy 2 beers and pass it around among us. Max gave us dirty looks, but we didn't care.
Years later, Lorraine and Max developed a friendship rooted in their love of music. They were married in 1948 and had 2 daughters. And although Lorraine was very knowledgeable about jazz, she never worked at the club until the last few years of Max's life, when he began to need help.
See, Max saw me as the wife and mother of our 2 daughters, and no, I never worked there. I never interfered in Max's business, except to go and hear the music or, yeah, talk about musicians, you know, but I didn't tell them who to book or, oh, maybe I did. I don't, you know, it was just common conversation. When he was getting really low in spirit and feeling ill, then he'd ask me, could I do this? Could I come in? And I did, and I learned as I went.
Well, I have my wife now joining me in operating the place, and it's a good thing for me because I'm getting kind of tired.
Max Gordon, in 1987, from NPR's Ben Sidran on record.
Sometimes my age is creeping up on me, and she's able to give it a little help which it needs. And it's good to have her. I mean, I'm enjoying having her.
I think Max thought, now that it's over, when he died, the club would die with him.
Max Gordon died May 11th, 1989. Lorraine closed the club that night, but she reopened it the very next day and has been there ever since. She brings to it her love and knowledge of jazz, developed over a lifetime of listening.
I do the bookings. That's the magic part. And I do have to like things because I love the music very much. I've lived it most of my life. It's nothing new to me. But I have to make the choices. I don't intend to please everybody. I have a point of view. It's narrowed down to some extent by people who think I'm not far out enough, but I think I'm pretty far out. And they come.
Audiences come for both the debut artist and the established favorites. And no musician plays the Vanguard more often than veteran pianist Tommy Flanagan, who gets 4 weeks each year from his birthday concert live at the Vanguard in 1996. This is 1010 Dale. Gordon has developed very strong relationships with the musicians, and like Max, she gives young players a platform. Pianist Brad Meldow has played at the Vanguard since 1992 and made two live recordings there.
I'm so grateful that I've been able to record there. I think it makes a difference in the sense of what kind of audience is going to be attracted to the specific type of integrity that's involved with the Village Vanguard. Therefore its audiences, and hopefully therefore the musicians that play there. That's all going to kind of give a picture of who you are as an artist.
From his 1999 recording, Back at the Vanguard, with Jorge Rossi on drums and Larry Grenadier on bass, this is All the Things You Are, Brad Meldow. Brad Meldow first played at the Vanguard as a substitute pianist with saxophonist Joshua Redman's quartet. Both musicians value the small size of the club. Joshua Redman.
There's an intimacy here. There's a directness. It's a directness of communication that you don't have at a larger venue. The music, I think, feels that much more available to the audience here. People can really hear all the texture, all the subtlety, all the richness.
Thank you.
My One and Only Love, the Joshua Redman Quartet, with Peter Martin on piano, Christopher Thomas on bass, and Brian Blade on drums. The album is Spirit of the Moment, live at the Village Vanguard, recorded in 1995. Lorraine Gordon has been very nurturing to many musicians, but she does have a reputation for being tough. Joshua Redman and Brad Mehldau.
I've never incurred the wrath of Lorraine Gordon. I've seen people incur that, and it ain't a pretty sight. She speaks her mind at all times. And if you do something that upsets her or that she feels is inappropriate in her establishment, she will let you know, and half the time probably throw you out, you know? But I think she is that way because she cares so much about this place and everything that it represents.
The personality of a club, things like a quiet policy, which is a big term, you know, or lack of, all that comes out of the person who's really behind it. And it affects the audience that comes there because people get to know over the years that, you know, this is a place where we're going to go to listen to music and we're not going to go celebrate Joe Schmo's promotion, you know, with some jazz in the background.
I mean, if people talk too loud in the room while the music is on, they're shushed immediately. And if they refuse, we give them their money back, and there's the door. There's no more smoking there. I decided no smoking. You know what? The musicians are glad. They're not choking up on the stage, you know, with that romantic look of the smoke floating through the air and everyone go, you know? That's not so romantic. And I only did it by taking the ashtrays off the table, and suddenly the next night was no smoking.
I think you have to have a certain kind of focus and determination to follow through on any great accomplishment, and certainly she has done that.
Pianist Jerry Allen has played at the Vanguard since 1989. In many incarnations, with bassist Ron Carter and Buster Williams, among others, and as a leader of her own groups.
I think the Vanguard has always kind of represented creativity. The times that I've worked in there, I've always done what I wanted to do. I've always used the musicians I wanted to use, and I've always done the music I wanted to do. And I feel strongly that I have to go to the places where I can do what I really believe in doing.
Jerry Allen, live at the Village Vanguard in 1991, with bassist Charlie Hayden and drummer Paul Motion, playing Hayden's Vanguard Blues. Of all the groups that have graced the Vanguard stage, there's one in particular that holds sway. The Vanguard Jazz Orchestra has played every Monday night for over 30 years. It was founded by flugelhornist Thad Jones and drummer Mel Lewis, who went to Max Gordon in 1966 looking for performance space for their big band. Max gave them a contract for two Monday nights and charged $2.50 admission. By the second Monday, the lines were down the block, and the Vanguard Jazz Orchestra has been a feature ever since. Thank you. Tiptoe, written by Thad Jones, performed by the Thad Jones Mel Lewis Orchestra. You're listening to NPR's Jazz Profiles, a tribute to the Village Vanguard. I'm Nancy Wilson.
Vanguard. If we have what? Live bands. Yeah, most of them are live.
Lorraine Gordon is very involved with her clientele. In fact, if you call the Vanguard for reservations, it's very likely she'll be the one to answer the phone.
Yes, I say they're live, quite alive. Yes. Do we have live bands? I ask the honest questions.
It's all part of the daily routine. She doesn't run the place all by herself, of course. There are waitresses, bartenders, cleaners, the doorman. And she relies on her daughter Deborah and Jed Eisenman, who's worked there for over 20 years, to help oversee things. It's a lot to organize, especially when the phone rings off the hook, and the public can be taxing.
Cash or traveler's checks only.
The phone calls continue into the night, which can get a little hectic since the Vanguard office is also the musician's dressing room, not to mention the kitchen. The ringing phone doesn't phase a regular like saxophonist Branford Marcellus, though. He just answers it.
Vanguard. Branford Marcellus is playing here for the rest of the week through Sunday. Oh, okay, hold on, I'll see. Our list might be full, but I'll see. Hold on.
This fabled back room has been called the nerve center of the Vanguard.
Well, so what? His music is alive.
His music is
alive. He died.
But imagine if Stravinsky had only just played Bach and didn't become Stravinsky.
It's only about 12 square feet and is packed tight with office furniture, an industrial-sized dishwasher and sink, and lots of people. It's often mayhem. Until showtime.
Later. You're on, man. You know you belong here.
Branford Marcellus has great admiration for Lorraine.
Lorraine could have easily said to hell with it and sold out to some corporate entity, and it'd be Vanguards on every block in Manhattan, 6 in Tokyo, 2 in Paris, 1 in Berlin. She could have just pimped it and made a pile of money and got a house in Acapulco and never been heard from again. But she sticks in here. She sticks in here for what reason, I don't know, other than a love for the music. And she resists all of the temptations and the trappings of that kind of success to do it the way she thinks it should be.
She's reminded why she does it almost every night as she watches the faces in the crowd.
Boy, that's a beautiful scene when you see everyone riveted at those musicians on the stage and really digging it. Man, that's the whole story of the Vanguard and running it and listening. That's my reward at night after I go through the leaks in the ceilings and all the other problems. But that's my reward. It's beautiful.
One musician who knows how to mesmerize a crowd is pianist Chucho Valdez. He wrote this piece for his friend, Lorraine. Chucho first learned about the Vanguard as a young musician in Cuba.
Cuando yo estudiaba música y el jazz sobre todo.
When I studied music, especially jazz, I would look at the history of the Village Vanguard and would ask myself, will I ever get a chance to play at such an important place as that? For me, it was a dream, a great big dream. I can't tell you how big. In 1978, I went to New York for the first time, and the very first thing we did was run down to the Vanguard to listen to the Thad Jones Mel Lewis Orchestra. Now, I can't even begin to tell you what it was like. When I personally got to play at the Vanguard, I cried. It was then that it seemed that I was finally fulfilling my dream.
Chucho Valdez plays at the Vanguard every year. He won a Grammy Award for his 1999 recording here, which reveals just how enthusiastic the crowd can get.
Chucho walks down that little aisle to get to the stage, and everyone stands up and applauds like in Cuba. He walks into a room in Cuba, they all stand up and applaud. This is bigger than life, this man. And when he sits at that piano, Well, he knocks me out, there's no doubt about it.
Valdez with Sound 21 from his Grammy Award winning Live at the Village Vanguard, recorded in 1999. Inspiring as recordings may be, and especially live recordings, there's just no substitute for the experience of being there, as Lorraine Gordon well knows.
Well, the dynamics of confrontation from an audience and a musician and the musician to the audience is irreplaceable. I believe that's the true essence of jazz. You never know what you're going to hear. They'll never play the same thing twice. No two sets are the same. Improvisation takes place in front of your eyes and your ears. And to witness that is the beauty of jazz. You're in on it, man. It's like you're there watching it happen.
We live in a time when entertainment is more available than ever. We can stay at home, watch 100 channels of TV, have any movie delivered to our door, and we can download music right off the internet. Does that threaten the livelihood of a place like the Vanguard? For one of its early performers, it's a concern. Harry Belafonte.
Since we are so confused as a nation about who we are and what we would like to be, I think that's reflected in our culture as well. What happened at places like the Village Vanguard is that you were really connected directly to your own heart, your own soul. And the intimacy of the Vanguard gave us a chance to look into the eyes and even hear the breath and the murmurs of your audiences as they've responded from song to song. There was a humanity in that room. There was an exchange between people that I think the only time you can see it now is when you go back down to the Vanguard.
Writer Nat Hentoff, in his foreword to Max Gordon's 1980 book about the Vanguard, surmised that the place had lasted so long because of passion, the passion of its performers and of its owner. It must still be the case, since the Vanguard has not only survived, but continues to thrive in the 21st century. Nat Hentoff.
Usually when somebody like Max, who is so singular and so committed to what I consider the free spirit of the music, which means real individualism, when somebody like that dies, often the tradition, including the institution, even though it keeps the name, dies with him. But Lorraine deserves credit because the Vanguard still lives.
There's no secret about it, really. You know, the New Yorker magazine calls us the greatest jazz club in the world. I don't call it that, but they do.
Max Gordon in 1987.
I mean, every day somebody comes up and tells me, well, I've come in here for 30 years, 20 years, 11 years. And, you know, I hear this, and I begin to feel that maybe there's something to the place. And that the people who call it the greatest maybe know what they're talking about.
Thank you. Our tribute to the Village Vanguard was written and produced by Molly Murphy, post-production engineer Andy Rosenberg. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens, senior producer Margaret Howes, assistant producer Madeline Smith, administrative assistant Linda Browen, website coordinator John Murphy. Special thanks to Arturo Gomez from WDNA-FM Miami, to Ben Sidran, Reese Ehrlich, Claudio Sanchez, and Dan Morgenstern. To email us or for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org or check us out at nprjazz.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, seeking to enrich community life through support of education, arts, and culture. Additional support has been provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR, where jazz lives.
You've been listening to an encore broadcast of Jazz Profiles. This tribute to the Village Vanguard was produced in 2001. Discover more great jazz at NPR Music, including our new series, Live at the Village Vanguard, live webcasts and archives from America's premier jazz club. Check it out at nprmusic.org.